Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ventures, a new show where my guests and I get to explore market landscapes, problem spaces, entrepreneurial stories, and explore together how new ventures might be able to be created, either for profit or nonprofit, to benefit humanity. In today's episode, I'm going to be interviewing Amanda Hightower and Brent Turner. Amanda is the executive director of REST, which stands for Real Escape from the Sex Trade. And Brent is the board chair and a seasoned business executive. And examining the relationship between Brent and Amanda, I think, lays an important example for any entrepreneur starting either a for-profit or nonprofit venture and what they should be looking for in an advisor and hopefully a board chair as the organization grows. So in today's episode, we're going to be looking at human trafficking in general and specifically the sex trade in Seattle. And we're going to be looking at not only the horrors of what's going on there and what's been happening over the last decade, but we're going to look at specifically how REST has been going about serving human beings, growing a team, interacting with volunteers in order to tackle this problem space. And what comes through loud and clear in this episode is that Amanda has set a tone and a vision and a mission for the organization to make it extremely clear that everyone is deserving of love, especially the clients that they serve. So as a fellow board member, over the past decade, I've had an opportunity to see up close and personal how the relationship between Amanda and Brent, with other board members, and the leadership team, and the volunteer community, and everyone that supports REST, how that has established an extremely important dynamic that has enabled the success of this organization in the problem space in the greater Seattle area, and how they work with law enforcement, etc. So we cover a lot of ground in this conversation. Thank you for being here. Thank you for watching. Thanks for listening. If you're listening, you can watch any of these episodes by visiting wclittle.com. So with that, please enjoy the show. All right, welcome, Amanda, Brent. I'm excited to have you both here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Will. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. So I figured we'd start by just some personal intros to get to know the two of you more. Amanda, would you kick us off?
Yeah, sure thing. Amanda Hightower. I'm one of the co-founders and executive director of REST, which stands for Real Escape from the Sex Trade. I've been doing that for about 10 years and have known both of you for most of that time, if not longer. Will, I think we go back even further than that.
That's right. Welcome.
Thanks.
And I'm Brent Turner. I'm the chair of the board of REST. I don't consider myself a co-founder, but as far as it being a 501c3, I certainly was a co-founder in that way. I've been at it for 10 years. Maybe this is my 10th year, and I've been volunteer the whole way. Professionally, I'm the chief operating officer of Rover.com, my 7th year there. And before that, I've done a bunch of different things, largely in the tech space.
Cool. Welcome. So Amanda, take us back. What was your journey before REST, and what were the events leading up to the start of the organization?
You want to go all the way back to when I worked at Best Buy selling computers, or?
Yes, please. Go all the way back.
Well, I had been involved in retail management for about 5 years with Best Buy, which is, I just love Best Buy, by the way, still.
Nice.
Bleed blue and yellow. But there was something that was just not sitting well with me over time as I thought back to this long desire I had to be involved in creating social change or helping people or responding to problems. And after a while, selling computers just didn't really fit with that value I held. And so I went back to school and got my degree in psychology at Northwest University here in Washington, and started working with an organization called Friends of Youth in East King County, which is kind of close to Seattle, on the east side, working with homeless youth and young adults. And it was through that work that I started to learn more about sexual exploitation and sex trafficking, and realizing that many homeless youth and young adults were at high risk of being recruited for trafficking or were involved in the sex trade to survive. And that's when the seed got planted for me, like, that this was an issue that needed to be addressed. That was back in 2007. Mm. And so it was, that's kind of the leading up to how the wheels started really spinning around this. I think it was a newer topic. Some folks had been involved in anti-trafficking work for quite a while and had been addressing the issues, but it really wasn't a popular topic. But as we did late night outreach and started to build relationships with young women who were being exploited, I realized that the services that worked for general homeless youth and young adults who weren't being trafficked, those services weren't working for trafficking victims. And now having 10 years into it, I can explain more about why that was. But at the time, it wasn't making a lot of sense. What I knew is that when we would get trafficking survivors connected to services, they would not stay or they would get kicked out relatively quickly. And they didn't integrate well with those services. And I think largely because the providers weren't really prepared to serve trafficking survivors in the way that they needed to be served, with an understanding of trauma, years and years and years of trauma, and how that shows up in a person's life.
So wait a minute, back up a minute. You said late night outreach. I think when we first met in that 2008 timeframe, you were doing that. And when you say we, who's we? So what prompted the let's do late night outreach? What is late night outreach, and who were you doing it with?
Yeah, so this is actually still when I was at Friends of Youth. So before even having the concept of REST, we did late night outreach with that organization as part of one of our government contracts to reach homeless youth and young adults, and specifically to focus on reaching out to sexually exploited individuals. So it was me and a couple case managers and some peer outreach staff. We did late night outreach once a week.
And what does that mean? What is late night outreach?
We drive out to different areas of town that's known to be places where prostitution occurs, places where men would go to buy sex and purchase sex. So it's otherwise called a track, where street-based prostitution happens, and kind of walking along the track and providing a way for individuals who might be prostituting or being trafficked to start up a conversation and see if they have any needs, and provide some resources for them, and then provide relationship and information and be able to connect them to whatever it is that they're looking for. And sometimes it's immediate, like, I need to go to the hospital, or I need a safe place to stay tonight, or I want to get out. And that's not as often as it's just a brief conversation, handing out a hygiene pack, or just a business card or an outreach card that lets them know who they can reach out to if they do want to talk at a later time. But just being consistent and building trust in the same place, so that if they have needs, then we're there to respond.
So you were going out was this the middle of the night, essentially?
At that time, it was between, I guess, it would vary. Like, we would do afternoon outreach. Sometimes we would do 8 to 10 p.m. At Friends of Youth, we went out earlier. I think when REST got started, we started with outreach and we did late night outreach, and we would sometimes be out till 2 a.m. So I think over the years it adapted based on what we were seeing as we got more involved.
That makes sense. Yeah. So what is the, back then, and I'm curious if this has changed at all, but back then, what was the emotion? So you're out on the street, you're befriending women and men on the street. Mm-hmm. What is the emotion? How are they feeling? What is that interaction like?
Yeah, well, I think it depends. Each person is unique, but understanding street outreach is, it's like talking to somebody when they're in the middle of required work. Most of the time it's about making sure they're able to stay safe, not putting them in danger, or putting them at risk by having a conversation with somebody that they might not be able to have a conversation with or shouldn't have a conversation with. And just really trying to Keep it brief, keep it quick, and increase options so that they know there is more support available. Sometimes we would talk to people who were just friendly and wanted to make connection and just have a conversation and just felt encouraged to know that somebody I was out there caring about them, and keep it brief and quick and, you know, just a wave. Other times it was heavy. It was emotional, especially if somebody just got out of a bad date, which would be like if they were assaulted by the person who was buying sex from them, and just, you know, tears and sitting with them and trying to help them come up with a safety plan or kind of next steps for how they might receive the care that they need. And then there are times where I think you have to be kind of tough and like, hold it together while you're out there doing something that maybe you don't want to do. And so there might be very little emotion connected to the conversation or the interactions that we would have, because to let in the emotion is to essentially acknowledge that I don't want to be doing what I'm doing. And that isn't always safe when you're in the midst of having to exchange sex. So it varies from person to person.
So for you personally, that the journey from Best Buy and school and into this space, what was it that prompted you personally? What drew you to wanting to raise your hand and jump in and help out in this area?
Yeah, so as I mentioned back in 2007, doing this work, realizing that services just weren't working well for trafficking survivors and finding that there was very few providers that were even interested in working with trafficking victims. It just got the wheels spinning. Like I said, I was thinking through, what does this mean for me? I was feeling this just leading and call on my heart to respond. And then in 2008, there was a report that was released for King County saying that there was between 300 and 500 youth being trafficked on any given night. And I think that's what sealed the deal for me, because the report also recognized that there was hardly any services available to effectively meet their needs. And that one of the major issues for these young people is that they didn't believe there was a way out. And I knew from doing outreach that if we could build relationships and create opportunities and increase options and then be able to communicate those options, that perhaps those young people and others, because we didn't really have an idea of how many adults were being exploited, but if we could say there is a way and that it's, and it is like catered to someone with your experience, that perhaps more and more people would actually want out and take those steps to get out. And so that's when I started conversations with friends and folks at my church, and we had an interest meeting for folks who might be wanting to get involved and do something and be part of a solution. And a few of us at that first interest meeting back in November of 2009 had previous social service experience and experience working with trafficking victims and survivors. And so we decided to start up REST and do some outreach and see if we could be part of a solution.
Yeah, and what a journey it's been since then. So Brent, tell us about yourself. Tell us about your journey. Dive in a little deeper to what you mentioned before. For just your personal, a lot of our listeners and viewers are startup people, investors in startups, the executives and businesses that are growing at different stages. So tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we can talk about how the story intersects with Amanda here.
Sure. And how far back? I'll ask you the same question. How far back would you like for me to go?
If you have a Best Buy experience, feel free to share.
Well, you know, it's funny. Out of undergrad, I studied electrical engineering. And I, when I got my degree, I had this thought, which is I think I did really well in undergrad, so maybe I should go to grad school. But on the other hand, I didn't know what an engineer did. And so I couldn't get my head around getting a graduate degree in something I didn't really even know what it was. And so I was also sick of living like a dog from a financial standpoint, you know, giving blood from time to time so I could buy lunch or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I applied for some jobs, and I got a job at Porter Cable in Jackson, Tennessee, and I was a quality assurance engineer. We're making power tools. And I think that is where, that's probably my Best Buy experience. It's probably where I learned most of, you know, I set down most of the foundational layers in terms of my philosophy around management, leadership of people, sort of discovered myself as an operator with, you know, analytical sensibilities, some technical sensibilities, but at the end of the day, an operator, somebody who's good at making things work, who's good at, you know, in the startup, you always need somebody in the middle of that that's going to keep the patient from dying on the table while all the crazy people do the crazy things. And I wound up serving that role in businesses big and small, and have learned to recognize operators through a set of similar personality characteristics that are easily recognizable, but also unfortunate from a personal experience standpoint. But I went to grad school, and out of that, you know, wound up in Seattle at a startup called Avenue A. I think I was number 70 or something like that. Avenue A was a digital agency, and we were one of the first of two companies that had innovated conversion tracking online. The other one was DoubleClick, which is still around. And I was there for 9 years, learned a lot about technology, a lot about advertising, marketing, media, and a lot about networks and marketplaces, and had a chance to work with some really smart people to learn about complex issues involving yield, and really loved it. In 2007, I think Microsoft bought Aquantiv. We had grown from 70 to about 2,700, and it was the biggest acquisition in Microsoft history at the time. And I think Skype was bigger, and maybe LinkedIn was bigger. But at the time, it was a pretty big cash acquisition. And that I was with Microsoft for a couple of years. Was the GM on the advertiser side for both Bing and Microsoft Media Network. We took both brands to market. And I left after a couple of years, was with a company called Marchex for a couple of years, was working on their pay-per-call network, again, doing networks and marketplaces. I left there after maybe 2.5 years, and did consulting for about a year, wired up with this guy named Will Little, who was operating this thing called CodeFellas, and you know, for a nice little stint, was the guy keeping the patient from dying on the table. So that was a pretty fun thing.
Appreciate that.
And then went to Rover. I've been there for 7 years. So that professionally, that's kind of a glimpse at what I've been up to. Mm.
And what was it? Even back at your, you said you were doing quality assurance work, and that's where you discovered that you had a knack for operating. What was it about the operating a business and driving that forward and keeping the patient alive that was appealing to you?
Well, you know, it takes you a while to figure out what you're good at, because you're just good at it and you don't realize that you are, you know, it takes you a while to sort of accept that. And I think the older you get, the more you wonder what you're good at, honestly. But at the time, one thing that was really interesting to me is, as a quality assurance engineer, I was in the management meetings where I was, so I was aware of what we were trying to accomplish as a business from a improvement and metric standpoint, but 90% of the time I was walking around the shop floor interacting with the teams. And so I had a really good feel for what was actually going on the ground and what the difference was between what we were saying in the management team meetings that we wanted to accomplish, how we were trying to do that through leadership, through setting of metrics and goals, and then what actually happened. I learned a lot about how incentives drive human behavior. And, you know, manufacturing is also monotonous in that you're doing the same thing over and over again. You're troubleshooting the same problems over and over again. And so relationships become a bigger deal, and you have more time to sort of get to know each other. You know, every quarter or so, we would do a recall of some parts that I'd be responsible for. And when a recall paperwork started making its way back through the plant, that just meant 72 hours solid that you were going to work. And so you got to go through tough periods with people, and you, and that gave you big incentives to figure out how not to do that again. And what and what I started to figure out is, loved it. I felt summoned by the whole process. I felt in a way that I noticed that other people didn't. There were some days when I'd worked a long time. Let's say we were closing in on the holiday break, and I would be in there like planning the next year, and like, we're going to crush these goals. And you know, I'd have all these plans that everyone else would be like, dude, like, I just brought you some cookies. I don't want to talk about this. I want to go home. And, you know, I was very, very into it. And so that's when I started to discover myself.
Appreciate that. So where did your journey then interact with Amanda? I can't remember if it was me or Tim or something. I think you met Amanda through multiple connections. But what was that journey as you were meeting Amanda, learning about what she was doing, and then deciding to jump in and help get Rest going?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of my favorite life stories. I was on a plane. I was working for Marchex at the time. I think it was 2010. Yeah, Amanda?
Yeah.
2010.
Yeah.
We're flying back from New York City, where I'd been out there on a few sales calls. And a friend of mine, Andy, sent me an email that said, did you know that Seattle was one of the worst cities in the nation as it relates to trafficking? And it had a link to a Seattle Times article. And that's not what the article said. What the article said is that there had been a multi-city coordinated bust that had been done, and more victims had been recovered in Seattle than any other city. So you couldn't say Seattle was worse, but certainly that's not a great thing. Yeah. But I thought, no, I did not know that. I read the article. And then that article linked through to the study that Amanda was talking about, Deborah Boyer's study. I read that whole thing while I was sitting on the plane. And I remember this voice just saying to me, go get involved in this and do something about it. You know, I sat there long enough to confirm that that's what I was hearing. And I thought, all right. And so I started emailing out to people. I mean, I was aware of the startup or the nonprofit ecosystem, but not really that involved in it. But had quite a few relationships into it. And so I started emailing out to people saying, hey, I got this sense that I'm supposed to go get involved in anti-trafficking work, but I'm an operator. I'm not a founder. I'm not particularly creative, not a visionary. What I can do is find somebody who is involved in it and put a go pack on their back, you know, so that's what I'm looking for. And so I started getting introduced to people. And for the next month, you know, I met four or five different people, all who, you know, I started meeting the usual suspects in Seattle in terms of this work. And met some fantastic people, but nobody that I thought, okay, yeah, you're it. And so you and I were at the Cyclops. And we were having lunch one day, and you were getting my feedback on this startup that you were thinking about starting that would be a competitor to Grubhub. I told you not to do it, you did anyway. So that's the nature of how people listen to my feedback. But anyway, at the end of it, I remember saying, hey, man, do you know anybody that's digging into trafficking? Because I'm hearing that I need to go do that. And I remember you said something to me like, oh, man. Are you willing to meet Amanda Hightower? Because she just had this meeting where, you know, she drummed up all this interest, and I think that you two would enjoy each other and maybe be able to help each other. And so I was like, sure. And so we had this meeting that Thursday night at Picora's.
I remember that.
Which is sadly defunct. I'm so upset about that. But anyway.
Capitol Hill, come on.
Yeah. And I remember, over the years, I've met a number of nonprofits, and I've got these questions that I like to ask. And one of them is, what's your strategy? And what I'm trying to get into is things like, what are you going to do? What are you not going to do? What are you going to be good at? How do you measure success? And I'm never really, one of the reasons why I thought maybe I would get into this type of work is because I believe that there can be really good answers to these if the strategy is configured really well, and if measurements is part of your identity. And I remember asking Amanda that. She said, well, I think it's find the girls, tell them that if they need our help, we'll do whatever it takes. And if they ask for our help, do whatever it takes. And I thought, well, I think over time it's going to be a little more nuanced than that, but I really like that answer, you know, and I really liked Amanda. And so I thought, okay, and I told her, hey, I'm willing to help you. And I don't think, I'm not sure that at the end of this, you're going to think that I'm a particularly good guy. You may think I'm an effective guy, but that'll have to do. And I didn't hear from her for like the next 3 weeks. I think she was back channeling me with a bunch of people. Then she called up and she was like, okay, I thought I'd call you back. You can help me. And I'm like, okay. And then, you know, off we went. The early days, I was just trying to, I mean, the smartest thing that I did in the first year is nothing. Other than ask Amanda a lot of questions. I remember I was flying around doing a bunch of sales calls, and we would do either weekly or biweekly calls where I was just trying to get my head around how to think about some of the non-intuitive realities of the problem. I was really worried about wading in with the idea that I had ideas when I didn't know what I was talking about at all. And that turned out to be pretty smart because there's just a lot to understand. You really do need to pick your lane, and you really do need to think about it. We flew to Atlanta and to California to meet other places that were like REST, that were a little bit more evolved. We got to a place of where we thought we knew what the plan was, and we thought we wanted to start a 501c3, and we were at this dive in Lake City having breakfast one morning, and Amanda talked me into being the chair of the thing, and here we are.
Wait, I think we need to back up. First, you had to talk me into becoming a 501c3. I was not sure that I had what it took. I was, you know, I was really passionate about making sure that we could do the work well. And I feel like we still had a lot to learn, that I'd never been an executive director before. You know, I had management experience, but this was a whole new ballgame. And so I think there was definitely some influence from you, Brent, first, on just the kind of willingness to step out and take the risk and become a 501c3. And then I was like, well, if I'm doing this, then you're definitely.
I've been fortunate to be up close and personal with the formation of a good handful of nonprofits. And I'd say the two of you, I admire the two of you greatly. I mean, you're one of the best executive directors I've ever seen, Amanda and Brent. Not to toot your horn too much, but being a board chair of REST has been an amazing journey to see how you've been able to take your skills, your drive, your stay up late right before a holiday type ethic, and help coach Amanda and us, the other board members, the whole team, to really get after this problem. So I admire you both greatly. So I'm especially curious about these early stages, because this is when most startups, this is when most nonprofits fail. So the two of you were listening and the two of you were talking to each other and you had this meeting. So continue. Where did the story go from here?
Amanda, why don't you take the, I feel like I've said way too much.
Oh no. Yeah. I think, well, I just want to reiterate that year, basically all of 2011 was just so much listening and learning and kind of talking to anyone we could, reading reports, reading articles, just trying to learn so much. And you're right, Brent, I think we talked multiple times a week, either through email or phone or whatever, and just soaking everything in. And I think that really helped to build our working relationship. And start to envision what this could become or what was actually needed. And the folks that we were listening to the most were the individuals we would meet through outreach. And that was really kind of the heart of it, is listening to what do they need? What are they saying is working for them? What's not working for them? Do they want to be doing what they're doing? Do they want out? And over the process of building relationships and starting to see them raise their hands and ask for help and say, actually, I do want something different, or I need a place to stay. It started to give us some concrete information about what types of solutions were needed. And, you know, we didn't go into it thinking we had all of the ideas about what exactly would work and what would solve the problem, but we really wanted the people themselves to tell us what was going to work for them. And I think that's really kind of foundationally been something important for us, to let that drive the kind of visioning process, to be able to respond with solutions that were going to be effective, hopefully. But one of the things that came up consistently in that first year was a request for places to stay, safe housing. To be able to just be able to live and sleep and not have to worry about where you're going the next night, not having to worry about making enough money to pay a hotel bill, not having to stay with a trafficker or an abusive person. And so we started to really have a discussion around, are we going to be a residential service provider if we really do this thing? And if so, we need to raise money. And so that, you know, those were the types of conversation that led into, if we are going to raise money, then we need to be a 501c3, and, you know, really kind of starting to move us in that direction. And then, of course, was the question of, if we are going to run a residential program, who's going to manage it? Which is a whole other story. But really just kind of taking those steps to listen to, what are people who are being trafficked, who are involved in prostitution, what are they saying? What do they need? And I think one of the biggest things for me in that first year, the first couple of years, was realizing the stigma that was associated with trafficking victims and survivors. Yeah. There was one individual we started working with early on, and we were providing relationship support, case management support, helping her to connect to resources, and found that, you know, she had been connected to almost every service provider in the city and had been banned or barred from nearly all of them. And upon exploring further, a lot of it was due to trauma responses. You know, a typical fight or flight response is what happens when somebody's brain is kind of overloaded with history of trauma. And her common trauma response was fight. And I think it was often when she would be triggered and have those trauma responses, you know, she was often labeled as non-compliant or aggressive, and of course, pushed out of these providers. And this is what we were seeing in a lot of ways. But with her in particular, what we heard from service providers was that it wasn't worth it, that she wasn't worth it. And that it was a waste of time to try to do thing to serve this population because they were not compliant. And that was, I think, what really cut to the heart for me, and responding with this deep, unwavering belief that everyone is worth it, and that she deserves an opportunity to live a life without exploitation and to recover from this trauma, that she deserves to know that she is worthy and loved, and that she is capable of having a different life if she wants it. And I think that those early experiences that we ran into a lot as we started to build relationships with more and more survivors and connect them to resources, that really cemented our kind of underlying belief at rest that everyone deserves to be loved. And I think that really drives a lot of why we keep doing what we are doing, and really reiterating the idea of worthiness and inherent dignity and the value of every person, and that their voice matters and their life matters and their purpose matters. And so that was also, I think, really key early on to have those experiences to always look back at and remember why we're doing what we're doing. especially because the startup nature of REST was very hard and constant. Because once you start building relationships with people who are in need and you say, we'll be available and we will respond and we will do whatever it takes, it means you really have to be available and ready to kind of turn on at any minute and respond and show up. And sometimes that meant showing up in the middle of the night. Sometimes that meant showing up for a 24 to 36 hour period to help somebody get to a place, safe place to go. So it was a lot in those early years of kind of just doing whatever it took and learning what that was going to mean.
It's really an amazing entrepreneurial journey. I mean, what I'm hearing is that you spent a lot of time listening to the needs of human beings and listening very carefully and not just doing nothing, but taking deliberate action any time, day or night, to get after that. I think that's an important lesson for any entrepreneur thinking about how to get after their venture. Yeah. But particularly for REST. So let's go back to the landscape. This is the late 2000s. You both read this report. It said, if I heard correctly, 300 to 500 youth being trafficked, bought and sold for sex every night in the greater Seattle area. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then that's just youth. So what was the landscape for the whole trade just in the greater Seattle area at the time? Do you know those numbers or have rough estimates?
No, we don't. And it's really hard to get those kinds of numbers. And back then it was especially difficult. It's a bit easier now because we have some technology that helps us to identify potential victims of trafficking through online ads that are used for buying and selling of sex. So a few years later, probably around 2015, 2016, I think identified with the help of Seattle Against Slavery that there was around 6,000 unique phone numbers tied to potential victims in the Seattle area, just from a couple of websites. So we figured, based on that and based on our experience with, you know, how many people we were coming into contact with via street outreach and text outreach and our 24-hour hotline, that there is at least a few thousand adults who were potentially victims of trafficking or at a minimum involved in the sex trade.
And have you seen the problem grow or stay the same or diminish in the Seattle area over the last 10 years?
Well, I can say one thing for certain: the solution has grown. And without a doubt, there is so much more awareness now that there are options and opportunities for people to exit the sex trade if they want to, for people to leave a trafficker and start to recover from their trauma in safe and supportive environments. The landscape now is completely different than it was when we started. There's service providers who are working closely together. There's many providers who are who have embarked on trauma, understanding trauma and how to provide trauma-informed care. The numbers of actual victims still is hard to know because the data, there's not an easy way to collect that data or to collect it in a way that you have a lot of legitimate, that it's valid, or that you know that it's really gives you the full scope of the problem. So it's hard to say whether the problem is getting worse or we're better at identifying it. But the one thing is true is that the solution is better.
That's great. So in the last 10 years, you're basically saying that the landscape of services has provided more opportunities to help human beings in need. So what was the interactions with law enforcement over that time? How is law enforcement working with REST in particular and those that are doing services in general?
Yeah. Well, I think, Brent, I think it'd be cool to hear from you just about some of your kind of early concepts around how could the work of REST really support law enforcement's efforts? And then I can talk about what it's kind of looked like, how it's played out.
Yeah, I was reacting to a couple of things that we were saying a minute ago. You know, one is I think the language around the trafficking problem is changing right now, particularly in the wake of the Epstein scandal, in a healthy way, in that we're not talking about victims as much as we're talking about the demand side, the exploiters, the buyers. And, you know, I think anytime you dig into a nonprofit, or really anytime you grow in knowledge of anything, there is a process of figuring out that the world around you isn't exactly what you thought it was going to be. And Rest has done that for me in a variety of ways, but one of them has been to understand how pervasive the problem is on the demand side. Frankly, how many buyers there are. And again, those numbers are hard to come by, but the, I guess Arizona State is the last one who's tried to do a capture recapture study on this, and concluded that something like 20,000 in the greater Seattle area. So that's a lot. That means something like, if you're at a Seahawks game, there's one within a couple of seats of you, you know, statistically speaking. Hmm. So, and then, you know, that's pretty hard. That's not what I thought. That's not what most people think. I get the impression, you know, when we educate people on the problem and we quote stats like that, they're generally floored. Not everybody is, but they're generally floored. And so I think that talking about the demand side has become more and more prevalent, and a more and more accurate way of framing it in your head. It is an illicit market, and it really isn't. The starting point isn't about the victims. The starting point is about the demand, and that's what we want to talk about. The reason I bring that up is, in my brain, you know, once we figured out, like, okay, we're going to have to raise money, and it may be that we're going to have to raise a lot of money. A couple of tumblers fell. You know, one of them is, I personally am going to need to be in if I'm going to. I'd never ask anybody for money at all, ever, at the time, and. But my first thought is, I'm going to have to be in, you know, substantially. And so what are my questions? You know, like, what are the questions that I would ask, you know, if somebody from Rest were pitching me?
Yeah.
And one of the big ones is, you know, not to pull out the MBA and, you know, analyze the annual report too much. But, you know, one question is this about, is this about love, about caring for people, or is it also about a strategic investment in the battle against this problem? Because if it's just about love, I can give to it. If it's about the strategic, a strategic asset in the battle against this problem, then I feel like my willingness to continue on investing as a donor is a little more open-ended, if that makes sense. And that's where Deborah Boyer's report was so interesting. I mean, you know, what I got out of reading that and then talking to the Vice Squad and the Seattle PD was, look, to you, you're setting up services for women that don't exist, and men that don't exist. And that's great in and of itself. To us, you're giving us a chance to actually have somewhere to take victims, such that when it's time to pursue people legally over these crimes against them, we have a chance of getting a testimony. Hmm. Because if there's no services, then they expect to be right back in the hands of their trafficker, or you know, right back in harm's way, and so they're not going to say anything. But in a world where there's a fighting chance of them actually you know, moving on to a different life, a different community, then pursuing the cases anyway becomes a lot more worth our time, and we can, for lack of a better term, pursue business with pleasure here. You know, like, we can really, we wanted to do this for a while, and the resources haven't been in place, so Rest is a linchpin. Hmm. And once I got that, I thought, huh, interesting. So I thought, okay, yeah, that's exciting. And it's also true that most people are going to be excited about that, that I will go talk to. That excites me further from a giving and commitment standpoint, and that will excite others. And that has been true. You know, and for a while, I was trying to approximate, okay, are we making it harder to do business in Seattle? That's what I was really interested in. And I used to do, before they shut Packpage.com down, I used to do quarterly analyses in Google Trends, and I would look at the search term Backpage Escorts in Seattle versus other cities in the nation. And it was the case, and it has been the case all the way to the time they shut it down, that not only was Seattle's the prevalence of that search term per capita in Seattle lower than any of the other cities in the comparative group, it was falling at twice the rate. There were other interpersonal interactions that I'm not sure that I'm ready to bring up here that we had, where it became fairly clear that REST plus all the governmental and NGO organizations around us as a corpus were succeeding in accomplishing this goal. And I think Seattle Against Slavery has actually used some of these numbers that I was telling you in some of their materials. That piece, and I think we discovered that in maybe 2016. At the time, it had been hard for a long time, but things were getting a little easier. And from a spirit standpoint, at least from my chair, to look at it and say, hey, this is working. Like, and not only is this working, there may be a chance for us to help others in other cities figure out this formula. Then I sort of went into pour it on mode, honestly.
Yeah, the two stories that really impacted me in the early days. One is similar to what you just mentioned, that when the police and law enforcement bust up the rings of traffickers and they bring everyone down to the jails, it's the wrong place for most of those people. Those people need to be brought to services that can care for them. And it's interesting that you point out that the actual end-to-end actually enforcing law is a key part of that. I think that's a part of that picture that I hadn't known about before. But yeah, I mean, my heart breaks for thinking of all the people that were brought to the jail system when in fact they are just being enslaved, right? So imagine being enslaved, being brought to jail. What do you do? How do you handle that? How do police handle that? How do the people working in the jail system handle that? And that heavily impacted me. The second story, which is tangentially related, is hearing Amanda, you talk about this, and then hearing it directly from human beings that REST was serving. It was that the process of trafficking is not something international. It's not people moving from some foreign country to another foreign country. It's literally a 12-year-old girl at the Bellevue Mall, sitting in the food court, being courted by a 16-year-old male who is wooing her, pretending to be her girlfriend, pretending to be her boyfriend. And that process of wooing people into the trade and then turning around and selling her for sex is incredibly vindictive. And when that's happening in our backyard, that invokes anger. That's what I remember her early story from you, Brent, when you essentially had the not on my watch moment, right? And I think once we hear these stories, we have to get involved. We have to commit our time and our talent and our money to helping to end this problem. So I commend the both of you, obviously, for getting after this. So where is REST today? What services are available right now for anyone who may be watching or listening in who wants out of the life?
Yeah, well, we grew fast and we've grown pretty wide at this point over the last 10 years. We have a variety of programs and services that essentially build out a full continuum of care. So We continue to do some outreach. Most of our outreach is has moved to being digital, to text outreach and being able to reach more people in a shorter amount of time and safer and more effective. We still do some street outreach. We have drop-in services for folks who can show up and just walk in and, well, not right now because of COVID, but generally speaking, when we're not under a pandemic, they can come in 4 days a week to have meal and connect with an advocate or somebody who can help them learn more about services that are available. They can shop for free in our resource closet and participate in support groups or classes or workshops. We have in the same place where drop-in is, and this is our Pathway Services Center, we have integrated health clinic, which provides mental health services and medical advocacy and support for getting folks connected to substance use services. And then we just recently launched in the same services center our Economic and Leadership Empowerment Academy to assist folks in job readiness training and working towards getting and maintaining employment. On the housing front, we have an emergency shelter that is one, I believe, still the only dedicated emergency shelter in the state for trafficking victims or people who are involved in the sex trade. And we also run a 24-hour hotline out of the shelter as well. And so we have 7 beds in our shelter. It's always full. And we get a lot of requests locally and around the country for replication of that shelter, because that's been one of our most effective programs. We get a lot of positive feedback from individuals who stay in the shelter. And then we also do long-term housing. So we have a transitional living program that is available for both sex trafficking and labor trafficking survivors, where they can stay for up to 2 years. And then we provide a lot of rental assistance and permanent housing support, really focusing on helping individuals get into their own apartments and permanent housing options. Kind of along this whole continuum is our community advocacy program, which is really just the heartbeat of what we do. And that is our advocates work with clients and survivors all across the county to provide relationship-based case management support, helping to just walk alongside them as they identify what are their goals and how can we help them connect to resources to achieve those goals and kind of move through recovery and healing to, you know, have the life that they want that doesn't include exploitation. We provide advocacy support and case management for all ages and all genders. And I've really been focusing over the last year on expanding to more focus on working specifically with male survivors, because they're often more hidden in terms of the victim population of trafficking, but they're there. And similar to what we were finding in the early days in terms of services for young women who are being exploited, we're finding the same thing with young men who are being exploited, that providers aren't really sure what to do or how to respond. So we're trying to be part of the solution there as well.
How has the current pandemic affected the space in general and REST in particular?
Yeah, well, we continue to provide services. We've just had to adapt what we do in order to follow the kind of mandated guidelines or precautions. So for example, in our shelter, there's not a lot of community gathering anymore. Folks are wearing masks and have to stay separate from each other. And we are still doing intakes into our shelter though. If we haven't had any positive cases on site, but if we did, essentially the county would have us isolate on site and just keep everybody there. And we have a special team of people identified that would kind of fill in, that have essentially agreed to stay working to keep the shelter going, even if there's a known risk of COVID on site. Our drop-in has probably taken the biggest hit because we haven't been able to have groups inside the building. And so we hand out meals at the door. We hand out kind of go packs with a variety of hygiene items, food, clothing, at the door, kits basically to kind of help people still get their basic needs met without having to come inside and put themselves at risk of exposure. And advocacy is still in place. So community advocates have been continuing to go all over the county. They're not meeting face-to-face with clients as much, but they've been delivering food and hygiene supplies and diapers. So many of our clients have lost employment because of the impacts of COVID. I think we put out a survey. We got around 55 responses from our clients, and I think around 90% had impacts related to their job, either losing their job or reduction in hours. And so there was a lot of concern around, were they going to be able to pay rent or buy food or keep their housing? So unfortunately, what we have seen is, you know, over the years of REST, we've kind of watched folks really kind of take these steps towards long-term recovery and change in their life and achieving those long-term goals that they've been hoping for, which is why it's been so exciting to launch the Economic and Leadership Empowerment Academy to do this job readiness training and expand job opportunities and really hope to see economic advancement for survivors. To have the, you know, pandemic set in and, you know, there's all this job loss, the focus on long-term goals has shifted back to just immediate survival and basic needs and short-term, can I pay rent this month? Can I get food? And so we just adapted and thankfully have been able to provide so many different grocery deliveries and supplies for our clients and rental assistance. We're hoping that at some point over the next year, we get to help folks move back to those long-term goals and kind of pick up where they left off. But I think it's going to be a struggle.
Yeah. So up into the pandemic and maybe even through it here, what have the numbers looked like in terms of impact? And what are the numbers that you track to even measure mm-hmm. impact? And how has that changed over time?
Yeah. So we have always been interested in tracking numbers. I think we're actually just starting to get better at it, but we've tracked a lot of numbers and really related to outputs, which essentially looks at how many people are engaging in the various services of REST. So for example, we might, you know, last year over 700 people engaged with REST for services either through the hotline or outreach or in one of the other services that I mentioned. About half of the people who engage with REST are enrolling into services, actually coming in to drop in or connecting with housing or an advocate. So around 350 that we do more deeper engaged kind of work with. And we also look at outcomes related to goals achieved. So how many individuals are gaining housing? How many are getting jobs? How many are reunified with their children that maybe have been removed by CPS at some point or held by family members? How many are gaining access to mental health services and showing improvement in mental health? How many are showing a reduction in substance use or abuse? So we look at those outcomes as well, really focused on we don't impose a path for anybody, but we have them tell us, what are your goals? Like, what do you want? Mm-hmm. We mark it down. And then as they achieve those, we celebrate like crazy. So we're really focused on what do they say they need and are they able to achieve it through our support? And so we track that over the years. We also, of course, look at our folks leaving the sex trade, you know, especially if that's something they've said that they want to do. And so I think we might be close to hitting 200 people having celebrated 1 year out of the sex trade since we began, which is awesome.
Wow.
It's pretty cool. It's, you know, the 1 year mark is a huge celebration for us. We talk about interruptions from the sex trade, which is just essentially, you know, 24 hours without having to exchange sex for something of value. And so we celebrate that as kind of the first step, but and then 30 days, 60 days, and all the way up to a year. And we have celebration nights in our drop-in center where folks get to come and talk about all of those different wins that they've seen in their life and the things that they've been able to do. And it might just be, I didn't use drugs in the last 24 hours, you know, or I haven't taken a date in 9 months. And those are just really fun celebratory times where we get to talk more about what's the impact of our work.
That's absolutely amazing. I mean, what is the funnel? So you talk about 700 people engage on any given month, 350 start working through the services. Those numbers, I'd imagine, add up super fast. You talked about the end of the funnel, 1 year or more, coming up on 200 individuals. But what do those numbers look like for commonly a week out of the life, or a month out of the life, or 6 months? What do those numbers look like?
I might not be following your question. Can you ask?
I'm trying to get a sense for how often do you see people leave the life through rest services that maybe are just out for a week and then they fall back in, or they go out for a month and then fall back in. So I'm curious, if you track the one year out, what does the 6 month, or 3 month, or 1 week look like, or any of the numbers that you track, or is that hard to do?
Well, I don't. Yes, a little bit hard to do. I don't have that in front of me right now, but I think what we know by doing this work is that it often takes several attempts to fully leave the sex trade, and that's to be expected. The shame that keeps people feeling, there's so much shame in the sex trade, and a lot of times traffickers have used shame to keep somebody feeling stuck in the sex trade. And it takes a long time for that to be unwound and for someone to believe they actually are capable of a different kind of life. The life that maybe they believed at one point they wanted, it takes a while for that to resurface and for them to have the belief that they can take those steps. It takes a lot of risk. It's a very vulnerable journey out of that place. And so we often see a back and forth. So if somebody comes into our emergency receiving center, our shelter, you know, they might stay the first time for a few weeks and then go back. And we have a 7-day rule. So if they leave, they can come back within 7 days. And usually at 7 days, they're calling to come back in, and then they stay longer. And that's what we really like to see is our engagements. We understand that engagement in services is probably going to be in and out, especially in the first 6 months or so. But is it each time they come in, are they staying for longer? And when they go back, are they back for a shorter period of time? And so that's one of the things we look at. To be honest, we don't really harp on exiting the sex trade with, you know, in interactions with our clients that much. Like, it's not the top focus for us. Our focus is reiterating to them that they are worthy, and that they, and trying to understand what is it that they might want for their life if they didn't have to stay in the sex trade. Because we don't want them to think that our only goal is that they're not trading sex. Like, our goal with them is to help them believe that they are capable of having the life that they want for themselves. And so it ends up being like a background topic that we kind of monitor, sometimes silently in the background as they tell us about this journey that they're on. But it's not our primary focus. Our primary focus is, what do you want for your life and how can we help you get there? It just happens to be that nearly everyone we work with doesn't want the sex trade for their life. Hmm. And so we just focus on what they do want.
So if there was some magic way to measure the number of people who are served by rest, who go through a transition and realize that they are worthy of love, that would be the ultimate KPI, is what you're saying. Hmm. So let's talk about scaling. Right. In the startup world, we talk a lot about nail it before you scale it. Obviously, that's tricky because you never really nail it, and it's really hard to determine when you've nailed it. But how can rest, or how is rest, or how are you personally planning to scale out to the rest of the country or potentially the world? And and or help out others doing that? What does that look like? How do you think about that?
Well, I think we, you know, should talk about this at our next board meeting, Brent and Will. I think it's definitely a question that has come up more over the last year. We have initially taken the approach of, let's do it really well here. Let's figure out how to do it well. And let's share everything we've learned with others who are trying to kick up similar types of services in their communities or cities. And I think that's really been our focus. We've mentored many organizations. We love to share information for free, come alongside folks. A few years ago, I got involved with a group that helped start up the National Trafficking Sheltered Alliance. And that's really where I've been focusing a lot of my energy to take our learnings from REST and funnel it into this group where it's being shared with, you know, 100 different service providers who are starting up, who are providing residential services for trafficking victims, and who are just really trying to learn, like, how can they do this well and how can they do this effectively. So we try to do whatever we can to take our learnings and influence the larger movement nationally with information and education and mentoring and consultation. And I think the National Trafficking Sheltered Alliance has been so effective at being able to pull people together to have this learning and to bring open minds to figure out how can we do this better. So I could go on about the National Trafficking Sheltered Alliance, but I think there is another question for us, and that is, in communities where cities don't have existing providers, or they don't have individuals or folks who are starting something up, or organizations who are taking more on, like, is there a role for us to consider expansion or scaling or moving into other parts of the country to support services, to provide services, if we're being asked to do so? That'll be an ongoing question for us. I think there's probably good reason to consider that approach. If no one else is doing it, why not us? Especially if someone's asking us to. Yeah. So,
what would you say to the individuals that might be watching or listening in who feel compelled to want to bring these types of services or start up these types of services in their city? What should they do? What advice would you have for them?
Yeah, so I have always said, like, find who is doing it first in your community. Volunteer, get connected, see what you can do to support them, see how you can help them expand. There are already, you know, trafficking victims are already, they are interacting with services somewhere in every community, whether it's health services or social services. And so there have to be some people on the ground who recognize that. And so find those people, get connected with them, and figure out how to identify more about the problem in your area and what might true solutions be, and let the people who are being exploited inform those solutions. And then go do a bunch of learning and find the experts and bring them in. And often the experts are people who have walked that journey of healing and recovery from trafficking themselves. And so really focus on finding those people. I think you can't do enough learning, especially early, to before you get something up and running.
Yeah. And Brent, as I get to know more of the startup communities around the country and around the world, I hear more and more people that are investors, that are board members of for-profit enterprises, want to get more socially involved in their communities. They want to help social impact, whether for-profit or nonprofits. What advice would you have to those individuals around being aware and potentially helping out or finding future Amandas in their cities?
Well, I don't know that there's any more Amandas. As we've been talking along, you know, one of the things that has really struck me is, Amanda does a really good job of talking matter-of-factly about what REST is today. But to me, there's a backstory to every single expansion and every single move that we've made, which is that Amanda's judgment and determination to execute well has just been the backdrop for all of it. And I don't know of another person in my life that goes from the high level, can go to the high level, okay, here's what needs to happen next with the organization, all the way down to the low level execution so fluidly, and continues to get better at it. And so I don't think you can do a podcast about REST without pointing that out. She's a shocking person on a variety of levels. And you know, a lot of my commitment has just been, you know, I can't, as a man, I can't really participate in the service delivery, but, you know, I can't interact with the clients, the way that the staff does. But I see what that requires. And, you know, if you're going to be on the team, you're going to be backing up that team. You got to be in a big way. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to say that. I think,
well, I'm just going to say, I really appreciate that. And just so you know, I've taken notes for my next review.
Right on. Well,
thanks for saying that. I appreciate that. I think it truly has been a team effort, though. Program development is my niche, and that's, I think, where I've been strongest. Learning how to lead as an executive has been a big growing experience for me. Hardest thing I've ever done, and at times the loneliest thing. But certainly have appreciated the support I've had around me, for sure.
Right on. You know, I don't know that the process that I went through is one that, because I feel like, you know, thus far it's worked out really well, necessarily is one that you can just sort of go out and replicate, sort of a sample of one, and, you know, a set of Six Sigma events all stacked behind each other. but I would say that you do need to pick your lane. In you know, what somehow or another, you have to get to what cause are you passionate about? Like, where do you think your involvement needs to be? And then I think you need to be ready for the idea that search and qualification of the organization that you're going to work with is going to take some time, and it's going to require asking quite a few questions. And I feel like that's something that I did well, although again, you know, once I ran across Amanda, then it was just sort of over. So I don't know how easy that is to replicate. I do think that staying away from an understanding like, oh, I'm going to go to a subscale nonprofit and going to impress them with my strategic thinking is just something not to think about. Like, you're either going to get involved, like you're either going to, I mean, the first thing that I did with Amanda was just hand her my checkbook, and she was like, sweet, we do need some stuff. And I'm like, hey, you know, give me that back. So you do need to be willing to get in it in a very real way. And you know, there are, particularly in the early days, there were many times when work would get really, really busy, but then we'd have something come my way that really did sit in my lap, that really was my responsibility to deliver. And, I would look at these things and say, I don't know how I can get all this done, but the answer is tough. Like, you know, get it done. And that's going to happen, and you need to know that going in, and you'd be better off not to go at all if you're not ready for that. And in some ways, I don't think if other people's experience winds up being like mine, there's some parts of this that there's no way to be ready for. But you have to be realistic. You have to know that very, very uncomfortable experiences and workloads can result and are more likely than not. And then the other thing is just to ask a lot of questions. I think it's very, very easy for the MBA types, and I am a holder of said degree, to walk up and say, well, like, you know, why don't we just apply this strategic model to this thing? And, you know, it just doesn't work that way. It doesn't on a variety of levels. And Amanda has had a fairly amazing combination of toughness and tenderness and landing those points with me over the years. You have to study and listen and really pay attention. And there are some things from the business world or from the startup world that translate very smoothly and that nonprofits can pick up with and say, oh, that actually will work. And then there's a whole bunch of things that seem like orthodoxy in the startup world that just do not translate to the nonprofit world. You have to get a sense for what those are and get a sense and then really reflect on, okay, so for example, taking metrics and assigning them out to the individual level works in the startup world. That doesn't work as well in the nonprofit world for a variety of reasons. And instead of saying, well, like, you know, I'm going to force this issue, you need to reflect on, okay, well, what problem am I trying to solve by assigning the metrics in the first place? And what's another way to address this in the nonprofit? And it turns out there are ways to do that do work. But you do have to be willing to back off on some of your very, very basic assumptions coming in, I would say.
Yeah, so a bunch of questions. And I'll keep this relatively short. But when it comes to those differences of for-profit and nonprofit, obviously nonprofits have to raise money constantly in the form of donations and have to recruit and manage a army of volunteers. Those nuances probably affect those differences that you talked about, Brent. But is there advice that you would have for a budding entrepreneur who is considering whether to take their idea for social impact in the for-profit direction or the nonprofit direction? So I talk to a lot of these individuals and I try to do my best to advise, but I'm curious how you would help them navigate that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I have one of those proposals in my inbox this morning that I'm giving somebody advice on. I think a lot of it comes down to the difference between for-profit and nonprofit is going to come down to unit economics and what do you consider a unit and are you going to make money in a for-profit world? And most people will frame up, hey, here's the opportunity at a high level. Here's Porter's Five. Here's a SWOT analysis, blah, blah, blah. Great. And you do need to have those things figured out. But your unit economic analysis, how much does it cost to serve someone? And then once they're served, like, how do I wind up bringing in money as a result of the fact that I have served them? And then what are the costs attached to, you know, let's assume that in the economic case, you consider a human being a unit. Sorry about that. But, you know, it is the dismal science. It's called the dismal science for a reason. You know, how do you quantify the investments and then how do you quantify the amount of money you'll make on the back end as a result? If you can get to a unit economic view that you feel like works, then I think you've got a chance at a for-profit enterprise. If you don't, then you have a nonprofit. To me, it's as simple as that. You know, we did not go into REST with the idea that we would make money doing this. And there have been and are people who are tackling problems that are different than the one we tackle, like placing them in jobs or helping them with professional skills, that they do have an eye toward a for-profit lens for that. Mm-hmm. And I have no objection to that. I think for-profit is the advantages of for-profit is that you can get to a place where it's self-sustaining if it works. And so donors or investors to the early going think, okay, at the very least, you know, I'm contributing to a good cause. At the very most, this thing could be a going concern. And there's nothing about the, you know, profits create self-sustaining dynamics, which are great. But I don't think, particularly in this space, that the inability to get to a profit model is anything. There's anything wrong with that. Some obviously I don't. Sometimes you're just not going to be able to do that. And so then it becomes a question of how do you scale the efficiency of the donations you get in terms of effectiveness as time goes on. And questions like that are ones that donors ask that are the most important ones.
I would love to follow up on that. We probably could easily have a whole completely separate show just on that particular totally. Topic. So really two main questions left. I would say, first one, Amanda, for the future entrepreneurs out there that are considering spinning up and getting into this space, or getting into really any general nonprofit space, what has been helpful from Brent? What has been helpful from a board chair in particular?
Oh,
you've alluded to a lot of the things that throughout this conversation, but what should a future executive director be thinking about that board chair relationship? What has been helpful and what has been not so helpful?
Yes, I brag about Brent to all my executive director friends all of the time, so I can answer this well. But I do want to just touch on one more thing related to the for-profit versus nonprofit conversation. I think, you know, I had to learn this as well, going from retail management to social service management. Like, there's a completely different culture and different vibe in terms of who's showing up for work at a social service nonprofit versus who's showing up for work at a for-profit, especially retail company. And I think I really had to learn the difference in approach and what it meant to, you cannot speak a culture into existence in this type of setting because it's so relational.
Yeah.
And so really having to slow down and take the time to focus on building those relationships and nurturing a culture over time. And I haven't always been great at that because there's so much work to do and I'm trying to get it all done. The idea of like slowing down to really kind of tend to the culture and the experience of everyone working on the team hasn't always been that easy for me to balance all of these priorities. But I have learned, without a doubt, caring for the team and making sure that their experience working at REST is that they also know that they are worthy and that they are valued and that they are important, that makes our work go so much better. And it's true. All of those things I have said about them are true, but I need to be so involved in like reiterating that and communicating that instead of just assuming they know it. And so I think that's one difference that I wasn't really prepared for in leading a social service organization. And sometimes when Brent gives me advice, I'm like, our people will never, like, that will just not go well. Like, I think the more hardcore kind of corporate speak or incentives or metrics, like, it doesn't fit as well. And so we have to frame our growth and our objectives in a way that makes sense for the people who are working in the organization. And now to go ahead.
Well, I was just going to interject real quickly before we get to the roasting of, and praising of Brent. Is that even in this conversation, I notice you've done an amazing job coming back to the vision and mission of REST. And what's come through loud and clear is that everyone is deserving of love. Those you serve with, the volunteers, your team, yourself, your board, that's coming through loud and clear. And that's the one thing I see for myself leading my own company and for entrepreneurs that I work with and coach with, that's often the hardest part, is over communicating, constantly communicating in various forms, that mission and vision, and infusing that. So keep doing that, because that's very important. Even my KPI question, you brought that back to a core value of where you're heading as an organization. And that's extremely important, I think. A great lesson for for-profit and non-profit executives moving forward. But anyway, to the question around advice around how to interactions with the board chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think What was critical for me from the beginning with Brent is that without a doubt, I felt him being all in. I never at once felt hesitant to ask him to do something. And I think at the time I was so like, you know, I got to do this thing. Like, we've got to respond and create a solution, that I had very little regard for what else he might've had going on in his life. you know, and he's an executive of in some company, and I'm like, well, that's really cool, but I'm going to need you to go buy sweats now for some folks who are showing up from outreach. So, and he would just do it. He would show up in, you know, our first time we opened a residential program. I walked in one evening and I smelled gas, and I was like, everybody out. And I called 911 and I called Brent and I'm like, can you just come here? I'm sure that the fire department will handle this, but we have a gas leak and, you know, it's scary. And so he did. He just showed up. It's like 11 o'clock at night. And so I think, you know, things I knew from very early on that Brent was going to show up. And that has been, I think, the most important thing that I needed as an executive director was to know that I'm not alone. It's also been the hardest part of being an executive director sometimes is feeling alone, and like, you know, the decisions are all on you and the pain points are all, the eyes come back to you. Like, somehow it all must be my fault when something goes wrong. And so that's a lot to hold. And I think knowing Brent has been by my side and supportive has been just huge. One time he said to me, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes along the way and have learned so much. And he's been so gracious and patient with me. But at one point he said to me, Amanda, you have yet to make the biggest mistake of your executive director career. And when you do, I'll still be there. We'll still support you. And that level of support and just trust and willingness to stick with me, even because I was always like, what if I screw this whole thing up? I don't know what kind of damage can I do here? And just that type of hesitation is not good for an executive director. So I feel like he's really freed me over the years to lean into leadership and make decisions and be willing to take risks, even if it means I make a big mistake, to know that he's, you know, he's still supporting me and by my side. I think the other way that he's been so significant for REST is he helped us so much early on in building a donor base, a very engaged and loyal donor base. He sought out a fundraising consultant and made sure we had a very strategic plan for how to build some early sustainable giving from major giving. And I think, yeah, it really catapulted our growth early on and our ability to then expand and increase donor cultivation in a really powerful way. But he's been, his network and his influence and his relationships have been critical to REST being able to grow financially and be able to do more.
So is there, what else comes to mind? I mean, keep going if there's others. I think this is helpful.
Yeah, I think Brent's humility is also something that makes him an exceptional board chair. His willingness to learn and listen and to not assume he knows more than everyone in the room is huge. And I think that that shows in the way that he listens and the way that he applies learning to the group and helps move the group along to collective learning and openness. And humility is one of our, you know, cultural traits at REST and values at REST. And I think he really models that well. And that's been really, it's been a good model for me. And I think for the rest of the board to see that. I think he also has helped us early with thinking about things strategically. You know, I have brought in some pieces, some reference points around metrics and measurements from my time at Best Buy, and like wanting to know that what we're doing is actually making a difference. So I had a piece of that that I was bringing in, but I think Brent's knowledge and expertise around strategic planning and thinking and even building budgets. Remember when we put that first Excel budget together? You know, I had no idea what I was doing with all that. And so, he really was supportive in I felt like there was just a great partnership of learning, and he helped me grow a lot. And I think I also helped him grow a lot just in this type of work. So it's been a great partnership. And I think for anyone that is starting a nonprofit or wants to find a board chair, you need to find someone that you enjoy as a person and can be friends with, because you're going to be spending a lot of time together, especially early on in the startup phase. So a lot of trust and a partnership for sure.
So Brent, on behalf of the entire REST community, thank you. We owe you a lot of gratitude. And the profile that I'm hearing in this conversation about the relationship between the two of you is extraordinary and admirable. So thank you to the both of you. So
wow, make this. I mean, does this go on another hour or what? Like, this is great.
So besides MBA speak and corp potentially tone deaf corporate speak, what else has Brent done that has maybe been not so helpful? It's okay if you can't think of anything.
It's easier for me to think of things I've done that have not been helpful. This is a good question. I think some of those disconnects between I think one of the biggest challenges that I have had as an executive director is figuring out how to manage effectively and build a team, a cohesive team, and also like do a job that feels never ending, like do all of the tasks that feel never ending. And it took, I think, too long for me to figure out what was needed of me as a manager, as a people manager, to run the organization effectively. And I think that was a miss, probably because we were both kind of a bit unaware of like what was needed for running, like managing people in this particular type of environment, that I think would have been more helpful to have some of that expertise come in around managing a nonprofit, especially in a social services organization. I don't think I've still nailed it, but I think that was a piece where some of the recommendations I think that have come, not just from Brent, but from others, kind of from corporate, more corporate-minded enterprises, just the way to manage people in those environments are very different than what works, at least at REST. And so I think it took me a long time to figure out how to do this well, how to lead people well in this space. Again, still learning, but I think that would be one thing where just remembering there's such a big difference between the cultural environments between for-profit and nonprofit, and especially social work in particular.
Sorry. I was going to say the same thing. I mean, I don't think determination can replace experience. And I mean, it's still probably quarterly that Amanda calls up and says, okay, here's what's on. Like, what do you think? And my reaction is, whoo, I don't know. And it's literally because it's my first time through these things. And so frames of reference that I have in terms of processing these things, at least the first go at it, sometimes are worse than zero. And from my perspective, like my first response is worse than like, I don't know, and just stop. And, so I would say as it relates to people in the startup world who don't have nonprofit experience, you know, just to try to be aware of those liabilities as much as you can. And as much as it doesn't feel good to have your ED call up and then have nothing for them, know that the what's behind door number two could be worse than nothing. So be really, really careful about whether or not to try to answer at all, or And you know, I think it took me a while to figure that out too. And I realized that I didn't know how to be the chair of a nonprofit board. And so I started asking around about who's a, you know, a good chair in town. And I wound up LinkedIn stalking this guy, Nick. I'm hesitant to call his last name because I haven't said that I was going to say this, but I inbounded him cold on LinkedIn, and he was a chair of another nonprofit. And I said, "Hey, I'm the chair of this nonprofit, and I don't know how to do that. Will you be my friend and help me learn how to do this?" And he did. And so we were like, so that's another thing that I would say to do. And once I got to a place of feeling like it was okay to call him and say, okay, here's what's on around, you know, compensation problems or, you know, donor-based problems or blah, blah, I think I was able to jump rails a little bit. But even those conversations wound up being pretty long because his response, his first response to whatever question would be so alien to me. You know, so I'd have to get through like a series of, but really, but like, that's not, no, like, no. And so, go ahead.
How much reserve or how much run rate should you have in the bank at any given time?
I mean, so for example, like I still have not accepted this, you know, that most nonprofits have 2 or 3 months of reserve, cash reserve. I mean that, you know, and if they have more, then they can actually put off their, grantors and inhibit their ability to actually raise money from grantors, you know, over the long term. Like, I still have not accepted that. And I know it's a fact. I understand why that's the way it works in the ecosystem, but it's still super hard. And the first time I heard it, I just thought, well, that's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. But it's not. And it's one of several very uncomfortable, non-intuitive realities of the nonprofit world that just seem anathema to a startup, you know, who is all about have as much runway as you can, blah, 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 blah.
So Amanda, where is REST heading from now? I know it's hard to look in a crystal ball and see what the future is going to look like. And especially in light of the pandemic, you know, it sounds like your priorities are in the right place currently, but what are the future plans for REST? Where's the organization heading? Predict that.
Well, I mean, still pending board approval, of course. But if I could predict where we're heading, you know, we are actually in the process right now of envisioning our kind of 5-year proposal for kind of where we want to go. And some of the things that are coming up now, when I use the term we, I say that because I'm not the only one who decides where REST goes. The people who decide where REST goes are the full leadership team of REST, which is 12 people who all influence the kind of day-to-day management and implementation of services. They're the ones listening to our clients who are saying, what do they need? They're connected to the larger movement to understand what's at play kind of on a broader scale. And we all come together and spend a lot of time kind of hashing through and debating and dialoguing about what our priorities should be. So in no way is my voice the only voice part of kind of the direction for REST. And so these ideas that I have could change based on how we all come together and discuss them. But I think what feels true for us as a leadership team at REST is that we want to continue to have an influence in expanding and enhancing access to victim services throughout the country. And this could be through the development of new services, working on a technology application that might provide a great increase in access to services. So we want to think through what are the impacts that we can have that increase access to services, and then secondly, that improve quality of care throughout the country for victim services, believing that the more opportunities there are for victims and survivors to find quality care, the less opportunity there is for them to be re-traumatized, re-victimized, and pulled back into a trafficking scenario. And it also makes it harder for folks to be victimized to begin with as well, when there's already so much attention to and availability of kind of a response to trafficking. It makes it less, there's less appeal to traffic another individual in that setting. So perhaps this looks like leveraging our relationship with the National Trafficking Sheltered Alliance to do more training and mentoring and education consulting. Perhaps it looks like replicating in other cities where we're being invited to come in and build. It might look like forging greater partnerships with other large or medium-sized nonprofits in the country who are doing similar work to kind of pool resources together and have greater impact. I think there's some really good opportunities to explore how we might expand, increase access, and enhance quality of care. The other thing I'll say is around quality of care, one of the programs within the National Trafficking Sheltered Alliance is around accreditation. And it's really around kind of setting minimum standards of care and helping organizations that are starting up or that are already implementing to meet those standards of care. But really what the national movement doesn't have are agreed upon metrics for success, or like how do you know if your residential program was having a good success rate or long-term impact? If some organizations are measuring success as, you know, they stayed for a month, or we only measure outcomes for individuals who have at least stayed for 3 months. Nobody's measuring in the same way to decide like what services are more effective or what types of services are more effective. And so I'd really like to have more conversations with researchers nationally and with NTSA and other organizations to see if we can start some research on standard kind of metrics of what could be some really good outcomes with survivors. And they can tell us like what those should look like, the survivors. And then we just start tracking them for 5 years during services and then for up to a year after services. So we can really get a good idea of what services work most effectively. So I'd like to see that sometime in the next 5-10 years.
So this is the exciting part of the podcast, because I'm not part of these conversations at all, but I'm anticipating being brought in on them. And so, you know, another piece of advice for startup folks is if your experience winds up being like mine, coming along in a nonprofit, the team at planning will somehow have mysteriously figured out how to push you to almost your maximum potential level of anxiety in terms of, you know, what they would like to go out and accomplish, but not push you over the edge, and then go out and deliver it. And so that has become more my expectation, and so I look at the anxiety as a fun aspect of the ride and not something to be dreaded. It's coming, particularly as it relates to this conversation. But I agree with all the vectors that Amanda's describing here, and you know, as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, oh man, am I going to have a bunch of questions, but I'm excited to get into it.
That's great.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's also unique about about REST and the way that the board and the leadership team at REST work. The board at REST has very much empowered the leadership team to make decisions and to at least propose ideas. The board doesn't direct the strategic plan at REST. They will, as you two know, process it, react to it, ask a lot of questions, push back if necessary. And that is a really good process. But I think there's a lot of trust for the folks who are doing the work. And they want to hear from the people who are actually doing the work. And not every board is like that. And I think, especially when you're working with a vulnerable population, the voices of those who are receiving services and who are attempting to change their lives, those voices are the most important to hear. And because of the way that we're set up, that happens. And I don't know a lot of nonprofits that are having similar experiences.
So how can people find you? How can people help? What is needed? And then where should people go if they want to give or if they want to get involved with REST?
Yeah, definitely. Well, check out our website, iwantrest.com. There's so much to learn on the website. You can learn how to give there. You can, if you're local in Seattle, you can sign up for a training day. We have some training days coming up in July where we go over the dynamics of sex trafficking and the sex trade, and we talk about all of the ways that someone can get involved in the work. So that's a really good place to start. My information is on there on the website as well.
Right. And Brent, how can people find you online if they have questions?
I don't do Facebook and I never tweet, but I'm on LinkedIn. So that's the best place.
All right. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Okay. Thank you. We covered a lot. I covered a lot of the things that I was personally curious about in those stories. I really appreciate both of you taking the time out of your busy schedules to have this conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Will.
It's been fun.
Thank you. All right. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. A few things before you go. Number one, I have a general newsletter where I write about emerging technology and blockchains and health science and software development and a variety of topics that we talk about on this show. So if you visit wclittle.com and hit the subscribe button, you'll be able to follow along. Two, you'll notice at that site, it is a project called Satchel. Satchel is a simplified online publishing and newsletter platform that facilitates the communication between a creator and their audience. So if you go to satchel.works, you'll be able to learn more and apply to be a creator there yourself. And Satchel is a portfolio company of a operator investor group that I'm a general partner of called Prota Ventures. And if you go to protaventures.com, you'll be able to learn more about what we do and how we serve founders to help them succeed. And finally, another portfolio company of Prota is Startup Rocket. StartupRocket.com, if you go there, you'll see a comprehensive series of guides and canvases and coaching material that will help you build your company, whether you're building it from scratch or whether you're looking to accelerate and raise funding. So with that, thank you. If you wouldn't mind leaving a review anywhere that you've watched or listened to this podcast, that helps get the word out and help other people engage with this content. Thank you.